commission members, but anyone in the audience, if they had a question or wanted to discuss some issue, I think that would be fine. How do you feel about that? Just real informal.
That sounds great. Now, our planning commissioners, you realize, right, we have our staff, but those are also two law students that have joined us this summer, Sean Rivera and Grace Bueller. So they'll be looking at this through their, squinting through their legal eyes as having completed their, survived their first year of law school. And a half summer of my war story, so you can imagine how confused they are at this point.
No.
Well, should.
Okay.
Should we just, you want to just start?
Sure.
Okay.
Can everybody hear me? I mean, I can stand up or do something different, whatever. So we're going to be talking about making land use decisions, and we'll do this through PowerPoint. And let's see if this works. So there are three types of decisions: legislative, quasi-judicial, and ministerial. Now, most of what the Planning Commission does is quasi-judicial, and that explains what it is: applying and interpreting law in a manner requiring exercise of discretion. Legislative is important as well, generally broad ordinances, you know, that cover certain topics, go to the Planning Commission for a recommendation. And the ministerial might be like someone has a use they want to do, and it's really an outright use, so they might.
So Jerry, that's the kind of stuff that would be done in our planning department.
In your planning, not so much here.
Stuff that never comes to you.
Could be like a building permit.
Yeah.
Could be.
Or an outright permitted use.
Yeah. Outright permitted use.
And some of our conditional use permits, in fact, probably a lot of our conditional use permits can be done administratively. Our department has the authority under our code to take a conditional use up to you guys. And our practice with that is, if we're even talking about, should invite my colleagues to participate in that too. Our practice has been, and we have this conversation a lot, if we're even talking about taking it to the Planning Commission, whether we should, that tells us we should. Because there's an awful lot of no-brainer stuff that we crank out. With a conditional use, people will get noticed. So if we've really missed something, then certainly people in the area can appeal and take it to the Planning Commission.
Okay. So we're going to talk about Fasano. In fact, I'll just advance this. But this explains the difference. And so if you have something like legislative, it'd be something like what you'd find in the Oregon Revised Statute. It's broad application. And so some of our ordinances are like that. And if you're going to apply this kind of law, like you go to the section 215, it tells you about some of the uses you can do in a farm zone or something, that's going to be legislative as an example. But apply it to a specific situation. Somebody comes in with an application for a certain conditional use, farm use, well, that'll be your quasi-judicial decision. So gives you examples: conditional use, variance, subdivision or partition, zone change. Those are typically quasi-judicial.
So Jerry, let me hop in here. So on that, the four on the bottom, we just talked about conditional uses can be done administratively, or they could be taken to you. Variance the same way, could be done administratively, but with public notice. They can be done administratively, or we can elect to take it to you. Subdivision or partition, the subdivision, boy, that has to go automatically to the Planning Commission, right? No? Doesn't have to.
It doesn't.
Okay, so thank you for that. And zone change automatically goes to you guys. We can't do that administratively.
Would the subdivision or partition then have to be within, where would it be located?
Sorry.
Would it be in a rural area?
Yeah, no, there are big chunks of property that can be further subdivided or broken out into smaller chunks under the Oregon. Not that many. A lot of timber properties can't really have that kind of stuff. So if there's some rural residential property out there that's grandfathered in, then under certain circumstances, if the arithmetic is right, they can take it, they can begin to to break it down into smaller chunks.
If I could.
Please, please.
By our code, though, a subdivision, you know, we're, we don't think of, you know, so many houses, you know, a ton of big development out there, but by our code is if you're dividing one parcel into four or more. So a lot of C will be, you know, five or seven, you know, small ones. It's just a division, but relatively small, so they don't come to you. I would imagine it was a huge one, you know, 50 or something would probably do that.
And sometimes people, because the requirements are less onerous, will stick to three, to doing three, and then sort of come back later and sort of avoid the actual subdivision stuff.
Okay.
Thank you, Jerry, for letting me know.
Yep.
Thank you. So, if it's quasi-judicial, it's subject to Fasano, due process. So, opportunity to be heard, present rebut evidence, impartial tribunal, record of the proceedings and findings adequate to support the decision. We'll be talking about that. This is the Fasano case right here. What's interesting is how old this thing is. This is an Oregon case coming out of Washington County. It was Supreme Court of Oregon, 1973. But it had to do with the zoning decision and changing the zoning of one parcel, 32 acres, one parcel. And it was already in residential. The guy wanted it in a modified residential form that would allow a trailer park. And Fasano was an attorney. He didn't want that in his backyard, you know, like a mobile home park. So this case established what it means. They didn't know what in the heck it was. So they pigeonholed it in this case as quasi-judicial and explained what that means. And in part, remember, if it's quasi-judicial, the applicant has the burden of proof. It's completely different than legislative. And the more drastic the change, the greater is you're going to be your burden of proof, all based on this Fasano case from 1973. See, let's look at it the other way. If you have a legislative matter, it's easiest thing in the world to get through, pretty much, because all you have to do is don't violate the Constitution or some statute, right? There's extreme deference to, you know, to the adoption of legislation. And it's generally upheld even without specific findings if it's based upon the law, and there's a lot of discretion. But if you have quasi-judicial, it's completely different. It becomes a burden of proof thing. It's
and
much
and
more difficult to pass.
An applicant.
Yeah.
There will always be an applicant.
There will always be an applicant.
There's a quasi-judicial. Mm-hmm.
Which is different than legislative. That's right. And as I say, we're going to be talking about these things, but there are a lot of due process elements to this. Okay, what about this one? Okay, well, that's just to see if you're awake or something, okay? Okay.
Sounds like the job description for the planner.
Well, so you got to think outside the box. So these are some, I won't read them all, but these are some of the things that due process typically involves. And I think you're aware, generally, that they do involve those sorts of things. It's much more formal than legislative matters. So key
right.
Statutes.
So again, for the legislative thing, issues related to ex-party contacts and bias and everything like that, they really don't apply.
That's right. That's right. Again, a lot of these formal aspects in quasi-judicial hearings go away. And so, for instance, we're going to be talking about ex-party contacts and bias and all that. But those are important elements to analyze in quasi-judicial. In legislation, you know, let's say a commissioner's going to adopt an ordinance, he can go out and talk to any Joe Blow in the public, and that's not an ex-party contact, that's not a problem, that's expected, right? And about anything goes as far as the legislation, you know, with a few exceptions. It could be a conflict situation. but that's not even likely. So very few formalities, that's right, including not the ones that you're talking about. So here we have 197-763. We're going to be going through those in the PowerPoint, a lot of those. The aspects are right tied into 197-763, and then additional procedures in 215-416. But they really, if you read those two, I highly recommend it. You can just pull them up on your computer. They say a lot of the same things, but just in a different way, but they track each other. This is what I don't like about our land use law in Oregon. It seems kind of stupid. We have two major statutes, sets of statutes, 215 and 197. Why didn't they just put it into one, you know? And it's kind of confusing sometimes to try to find something. Is it 215? Is it 197? There's not a lot of good reason for the way they do it. Except 197 is general, so cities would follow that as well. Okay, the application, but this is going to be handled by staff. Ano and his employees can do, there could be a pre-application conference. They're going to have an application form. They have a review, but generally what's important in their business is to deem at some point that an application is complete or not complete. But when it's complete, we're on a clock. And so we've got to have everything done in either 120 days or 150 days, depending upon the circumstances. Now, can anybody tell me what happens if you don't get the decision done in 120 or 150 days? Anybody know what happens? Okay.
Bad.
Ask for an extension.
Well, an extension is possible, but the bad thing
phone
is
call from Wayne Belmont.
Is that an applicant can file a writ of mandamus for a writ of mandamus so that this action gets taken up to circuit court. And then you're at exposure for attorney's fees and all kinds of bad things. But let me explain one of the reasons why.
Getting what they want ordered, that's the real bad day at the office.
Well, to me, the really bad day in the office is that almost every circuit court judge knows diddly squat about land use because they don't do it.
Yeah.
Land use is administrative law that goes to the local level, bypasses circuit court, goes to LUBA, the Land Use Board of Appeals. Appeal there goes to the Court of Appeals. And then if you can possibly get it to the Supreme Court of Oregon. So it bypasses circuit court. So circuit court judges will do lots of criminal law and lots of civil law. But if they get a land use problem before them, they're not going to know what the heck they're supposed to do. So I think that that's another part of the double whammy is the lack of experience and then the exposure to all those bad things, you know.
So, and the writ of mandamus really means the court will instruct what an outcome.
Yes, they will instruct an outcome, and it may or may not make sense. So you don't want to go there. It's bad, and it looks like malpractice when that happens. So do whatever you can. There are some extensions that are allowed under the statute. There are limitations on the extensions, and you can't force it. You'd have to voluntarily get that from the applicant.
So
an extension.
Before you ask your question, Sean, I do want to hear what you want to ask. But as a practical matter, this we call it the shot clock, right? So we sort of borrow basketball language, right? You got so many.
Oh, that's good. Yeah.
We call it the shot clock. In Wade's office, we have a big whiteboard where we put. We go, that's how, from a staff perspective, it's sort of our air traffic control device to say, here's where an application is, here's where it came in, and it's got the key dates lined out on it. So at a glance in the morning, we can kind of see where that is, and we add them and subtract them as we go. And also what it manifests with you guys, when an applicant is before you, that's why sometimes they're kind of in control. They can grant us more time. Are you going to get into that, or is that just practical?
I mentioned it. We won't get too much in detail. They can grant more time, but we can't compel them to give more.
No. So what if we get too close, and I'll from Wayne and Warren here. I used to think when I first sort of learned about the shot clocks as a staff member, I was going like, wow, that's really sounds, you know, that's a serious deal. But our remedy always is to declare, and we'll get into an application, as incomplete, or just issue a denial. So, I mean, that's where, you know, the best practice is, of course, to treat, you know, make sure we're trying to keep the trains running on time, understand what that shot clock is, and observe it. But sometimes when they come in here, too, we're paying a lot of attention to this timing issue for this very reason, that there's sort of a statutory, and I know what happened is years ago, some jurisdictions dragged their feet, even went to the legislature, and said, hey, you can't have these local jurisdictions just sitting on applications because they don't want development or they don't like who I am. Put them on a shot clock. So the real estate community and others made that happen. And so that's a big part of our day-to-day, where are we at, making sure we respond on time.
Good point. Okay, let's move on.
Sean, you were going to ask a question.
Oh, question?
The 120 days, is that just for counties, and the 150 is for municipalities?
No. No, it depends upon whether it's within an urban growth boundary or not, or if it's mining or not, and a few things like that.
So the statute will just spell that out there?
Yes.
Okay. And that very important point you hit on briefly there, I don't know if you're going to return to it, is once we deem the application complete and we take their money, then the shot clock starts. And so we're trying, don't we? I think we do this as often as possible. We try to keep out of the shot clock. We try to get as much information and collaboration going with an applicant in advance of them finally giving us a check. Because if we really don't think we can process it, we don't want to take their money and waste your time and our time. But if we're working towards something, we sort of really think we're there. At that point, it's not a done deal, but we take their check and they submit, and then we're working with them, right, to try to get additional information to create a complete application.
But here's the thing. When they say 120 or 150 days, they mean not just the Planning Commission represented here, but all local levels. So if there's an appeal to the commissioners, for instance, that's got to be resolved within the same time frame. And so this can really get very dicey at times because we don't control the appeals. Someone has standing, and we'll talk about that, they can appeal. And so let's suppose that we've continued it two or three times here at the Planning Commission level. Well, hell, we may not beat the shot clock, and that would be a disaster. So almost all counties try to avoid this.
If you're up against it, issue a denial, that's sort of...
Well, I don't know about that.
So the recent Brian Booth thing, is that different? Because that went back to 2016.
You know what? That was not our finest hour in terms of staffing change, how that worked out. And if State Parks could have asserted, and of course chose not to because they realized it was so much in play with us. But if you look at their OARs, I think that may be the one time in the 6 years that I've been here that the shot clock wasn't expired.
But I there is a separate timeline in the statute, and so I think that is the one that we may not have complied with. I'm not sure how it would play out because it's a little different. It's a different process.
It is a very different process, but we were mindful of that, and I think Parks could have, because I had a very... thorough discussion with that with the Parks Commission too, and there was sort of like there was a shot clock there, but of course they chose not to exercise.
Yeah, I think that's probably fair.
And we're not likely to have a state agency do that. It's much more an applicant.
Yeah.
That also thinks that an attorney might counsel them, let the shot clock expire, and we'll take our chances at in a different setting.
An example where this could come up is, let's say that you're the applicant and you're really getting close to the timeline. Let's say it's 120 days. And the Planning Commission has met and they make a motion to deny the application, and they say, come back with the findings in 2 weeks, and the 2 weeks transcend the 150 days. Well, the guy, you know, the applicant can file, because it's not a decision until it's reduced in writing and signed off. So if they don't meet the clock, they could forum shop, in a sense, and send it to circuit court.
And if they're not from here and they don't mind just damaging their relationship with the county, I think that's another informal. If you're in the area and you care about your working relationship, that's quite a card to play.
Yeah, it is.
You know?
It is.
They have a right to do it.
Yes, they do. Yeah. Okay, here we go. So approval criteria, generally it's going to be in your staff report. The question is, does the application satisfy the criteria? If it fails, it's got to fail. And if it can be found to comply, you can do conditions of approval. We might talk about that briefly. Let me go over this concept, but I think you're generally aware of it. The easiest thing in the world to defend in some ways is the denial of an application, because you only, let's say that there's 20 criteria and you don't meet one of them. Well, it only takes one out of the 20. It's not like 19 out of 20 you've got, so that looks like 95% you're doing pretty well. No, you're not doing well. You've got to get everyone to comply. So if we're going to approve it, and there's 20 criteria, we have to have an explanation that is findings to justify all those 20 criteria. That's a lot of work. But if we're going to deny it, and it's not really good practice to do this way, but we could just pick one of those 20 things and have a paragraph, and that's good for a denial, because it only takes one. And so I always have said sort of facetiously, the easiest thing in the world would be a land use attorney who is in opposition of different applications, because, you know, you just have to find one little thing, you know. So just remember that concept. You have to meet everything, and so frequently an approval order has got to be fairly complete, and a denial order does not, but generally it would be better to have two or three reasons for denial if you have those, because then if one fails, then you can rely on the other two. I mean, if you're defending something, if you know what I mean.
I couldn't disagree with you, but the facts are the facts.
That's true.
And whatever, you know, I don't know that, what we struggle with more often as a practical matter is they're not giving us sufficient information rather than information to make a judgment call, right? I don't sit there with you guys and wrestle, gee, have they made it or not? It's a lot of times is, do we have enough information to really decide?
That's really fair.
And in the absence of the information, then they don't have to provide enough information, so that,
yes,
they would fail.
They would fail.
So
if
it's
they
their incentive
have.
To, you know, help us out here and give us what we need.
Conditions of approval, we might go back to that a little bit later, but remember that you can't just do any kind of condition you want. I think, so for instance, conditions are supposed to be designed, you know, to ensure compliance. And so if you have ordinance criteria that says that a tower needs, you know, to blend in nicely with the neighborhood or something, you know, making it green or whatever might be part of that. But just to stick in an order, a condition that a fence has to be purple or something.
There needs to be a nexus to our code.
Yes, there needs to be a nexus to the code. And a separate issue that could come up is this concept of a taking, which could occur if you require something. So for instance, if you require the applicant to dedicate a road to the county or a certain area to the county or whatever, something, there could be a taking issue. So we always have to look very carefully if we're going to get an exaction out of it. The law doesn't say you can have exactions if it's appropriate, but, you know, there's a nexus and, you know, requirements of proportionality and so on. I mean, you can't require an applicant to donate a huge building to the county as a result of the application.
So those were a number of cases around the country in the late '80s and early '90s,
That's right.
Where the exactions, because it kind of got loosey-goosey there for a while.
Yeah, yeah.
There were jurisdictions would ask amazing things of people and finally said, this is a...
You've gone too far.
And so same thing on that. There needed to be some logical connection between what you're proposing and them to do. And it better be also what better be in a code.
Yeah. Okay, here we go. Uh-oh. Okay. So here are some definitions, some concepts, and let's go over those in briefly. So evidence is a very broad term. Evidence is anything, so it could be testimony, it could be a document, it could be data, any number of different things that's offered to demonstrate compliance. Now, argument is something completely different. Argument is not evidence. Argument is a statement why one side thinks that they should win, why the application should be denied, or why the application should be approved. That's argument. And remember, under our rules, the applicant has a 7-day period in which, after the record is closed, that they can provide argument. So nothing new, nothing evidence, but just an argument or a statement of why the criteria has been met, why they should win. Testimony is either written or oral statement by a participant. And everything that goes into the record, including argument, you know, everything that goes before the Planning Commission, including arguments, is what we call the record. The record is very important because many of your decisions of the Planning Commission get appealed to the Land Use Board of Appeals. And one of the biggest pains in the butt, but it's required, is that the jurisdiction from which the decision has been made, that is the staff, have to put together the record to go to LUBA. And the record will include, it's all in the OARs as far as what needs to be in it, but it will include the staff report, all the exhibits submitted, transcripts, it could be transcripts or tapes of the meetings. All those things go to LUBA. See, LUBA is like an appeals court. It's actually an agency, but they don't generally take new evidence. So their decision is based on the record, and that's why the record is so important. The record is put together, and it's bound in a certain format, in a certain way, and if it's not put together right, then the other side objects to the record until it gets right. And then no briefs are filed until all that gets squared away. So the record is crucial. Okay.
Are you going to tease out, because this reminds me of, I know how central, there's the record such and such, but the, you guys know that how important it is when you finish your deliberations, you're giving us instructions to develop the findings. Because even recently, after that one night with that we had in Salishan, and the allegations were made by Alpha Wave that I had misstated and manufactured some criteria that didn't exist, and they were determined to have it struck from the record. And so the next day, I'm talking with Wayne and Jerry about this, and Wayne pointed out, if you made an error, let's say I had actually mistakenly done that, that it really didn't matter because it was what was really going to be litigated on was an overall record, and if I had jumped the rails on something at some point there, that didn't invalidate our proceeding or anything like that. And as Wayne pointed out, and I really helped sink it in for me, is that it's that ultimately it'll be the findings that really hammers down, we're stitching this all, making that all work with your instructions to us, and then those findings. That's really what is mostly litigated over, right?
Yeah.
Have we met the substantial evidence on the record?
That's right.
To especially in those findings as a key document.
And we'll be talking about substantial evidence as one of the slides, so to speak. Okay, very good.
By the way, I don't think I was necessarily wrong in what I had said that night as Al Shaker. That's an aside.
Well, let's don't litigate that right now. Won't be part of the record.
We'll make some findings about that before the night's out.
So this concept's important, but let's put this in perspective. My other life, I've been a deputy district attorney. And so if you're in court and there's a criminal matter, the burden of proof is to prove beyond a reasonable doubt that someone committed the crime, right? Beyond a reasonable doubt. That's the highest standard. Some of the other standards are like a preponderance of evidence, and there's other standards. In land use, this is our standard. It is not that criminal standard that I just talked about. It's not preponderance of the evidence.
Which kind of means more than 50% shot, right? Preponderance is always...
Yeah.
Do they still teach it that way in law school?
Yes, that's right. So this is a different...
50, yeah, yeah. Any
yeah.
More likely than not or more, something.
Yeah. So this standard is really kind of different. And so our standard, you know, is that land use decisions need substantial evidence. So, viewed as a whole, what a reasonable person, that's an objective standard, not subjective so much. Would a reasonable person rely, what they could rely upon to adopt a land use decision?
And who's defining reasonable person?
Well,
you know when you see it.
Person. Yeah. A lot of times if you read a LUBA opinion, they'll kind of play with that. You know, they'll look at that and say, so-and-so has argued this. And when we look at it, well, that doesn't make any sense to me. I don't think any reasonable person would really adopt that view. You know, I mean, sometimes they'll say stuff like that. So the reasonable person standard, substantial evidence. This is critical in land use to understand this concept. And I think that in some ways it's a fairly permissive standard because frequently you'll get...
affording us a lot of discretion.
Yeah, a lot of discretion. I think frequently you'll have conflicting evidence. You might have experts on each side of a land use, and you frequently do. Frequently you could take one or the other. As long as you could meet the standard that a reasonable person could rely on that, you know. Usually if we were doing the findings, we would say why we accepted one thing and rejected another. Stick that in the findings. But that's pretty flexible to me. I mean, it can't be completely stupid, you know. There can't be a complete lack of evidence. That to me would be the Dollar General case that we had before you. It was, why don't you find for us because we're the Dollar General. I mean, I didn't get much more out of it than that. And it's all done, isn't it? I can talk about it.
Right, and it was, in all the years I was on the Planning Commission, and now the 6 years that I've been staffer, I've never seen a more shockingly incomplete set. I mean, it's just...
Yeah, it was kind of strange. But you would see that that would not meet this test because there really wasn't any supporting evidence, so... A
reasonable person tested it. If they had tried to appeal it and gone with LUBA, they would have been facing.
Yeah, that would have been a quickie. Okay. So notice, staff takes care of this. You know, they're earmarked areas. So and so gets notice. Generally mailed out 20 days before the hearing, or says they're 10 days before first hearing. That would, when bottom one got cut off, but I think notice may be posted on subject property. But generally, this is a mailed notice, and that's what's required. Now, there are different types of notice. For instance, if you had a legislative matter in an ordinance, there's a statute that says well, it'll have no effect unless you publish at least 10 days before the hearing. And so the legislative matter.
But published in a newspaper.
Yes.
Because there isn't an applicant or there isn't a particular property that it applies to.
Right.
With a notice area. That's either, right. That, there you go with the quasi-judicial. Our world, your world, is divided into those two.
Yeah.
Two things. It's either quasi-judicial or it's legislative. The ministerial is what we're doing.
That's right. So legislative is the broad notice published in the paper. Okay. So staff is going to do a report. You get those. They're required at least 7 days before the hearing. This is 197.763. I told you earlier it'd be good for you to review that. This is all found in that. And it has to be available for inspection. So anybody from the public, Joe Blow or anybody, has the right to look at that staff report. And we can't charge them just to look at the thing, but we can charge them for copies. But in today's world, it's almost antiquated language because you could generally email somebody something or whatever. I don't know what our policy is.
Well, listen, have staff reports, do they go on the web prior to the hearing?
Yes.
But there's a, well, that's obviously a very easy way for people to get a hold of it. You know, just recently for the first time, too, because there was so much interest in Dollar General and Brian Booth, and because there were so many people that were engaged in that process, we were sending staff reports out because in advance of the sharing, I don't know that we've done much of that in the past because some of these hearings are pretty obscure, but we were sharing some of these staff products with people in advance.
Okay. Josh posts the entire packet on the internet.
Is this what you do every, you post the entire packet on the internet, right?
Yeah.
As part of the
right.
Notice thing. Thank you. Yeah, good.
Okay.
Well, you get your packet.
Yeah.
So.
Okay, what do you think?
Well, people are mad at us. That's the kind of thing they'll go chase you down for. Hey, where's the, you know, how come you don't have it posted? And
does that relate to this?
Yeah, I guess it does.
Okay. So, public hearing. You know, we do certain announcements at the beginning. And I think one of the critical concepts about land use is raise it or waive it. Raise it or waive it concept. So, if the planning commission goes through the right steps and the commissioners after that, if there's a hearing after that, it would include this language about you gotta, if you can see a problem that, you know, procedurally you're not happy about, you've got to raise it or you're going to waive that. So
as long as you're standing for your minutes.
Yeah. So we're going to talk about how that works, but this is critical because the idea is to give the planning commission an opportunity to address a problem or perceived problem. If one of you looks like you have bias or something, the person can't argue bias before the Land Use Board of Appeals if they haven't raised it to you, where you would have an opportunity to address that. And so the other thing, you know, that's just an example. But the idea is for you to be able to fix something if it's not quite right.
And it goes back to the idea that the record then is closed, so there isn't some grenade coming in at the last minute.
That's right. There can't be any of that.
That nobody can respond.
Yeah.
You can't introduce new arguments. You can't really have new
facts.
If the record is closed, this is, we're all talking about this, and this is it. And if it ain't in there, it is not going to be factored in by the appellate bodies. There, it doesn't exist.
Yeah.
So you got to put it in the record at the time.
Okay. So we have three concepts here. Each one is different. Each one has different considerations. They may be related. They may look similar, but they're all different. And in my opinion, this is an area that we can work on a little bit. When this is announced, it's important for every planning commission member to think about their situation with respect to the application and have any of these things happen. And we'll go through each one. But frequently, the safest thing to do is if one of these things have happened, you announce it and you say, if this is true, you know, I'm not biased or I can still make a decision. I feel that I can be fair and impartial if that's the case, and maybe it isn't. But then if someone wants to challenge you or make us think about it, then they can. But if they don't know about it, then that's a problem, especially with respect to ex-party contact, well, with all of these things. So we've got staff, and this is sort of the order of things, and I think that you're aware of that.
The desk after the chair more or less asks for any part, ex parte, you know, goes through that opening stuff first, right? Asks for ex parte communications and that kind of stuff.
Yeah, so this is the pocket, but that's not relevant. Okay, so let's talk about ex parte contacts. So it's Latin from one part or one side. But it's a one-sided communication between a decision maker and some other person outside the public review. So here's the concept. Your decision is based solely and entirely on the record. It is not based upon extraneous things to the record. So if someone talks to you, let's say a party or someone with an interest in the case, like, you know, you should really vote for me, you know, vote for this cause because of these reasons and stuff. Well, that's an ex parte contact, and you're receiving information not on the record. This is not much different, I don't think, than circuit court. So if you can think about our courts upstairs, the judge is going to, or the jury, depending upon the situation, is going to make a decision based on the record. It's not going to be, you know, whatever. It's not going to be something different. And the record is what is said in the courtroom. So it's similar here. And where you can get a foul, and you might think, well, this is no big deal. But let's say that you have a really big land use decision. You have many of those. You've had many of them this year. Even reading a newspaper article about it can be a problem, because there could be information in that newspaper article that maybe an opinion about how things should go. That's not part of the record, okay? It could be someone coming to you. It could be maybe there's a big blurb of it on TV or something like that. We need to be careful about these things, because things are to be decided on the record. And so this is a one-sided communication outside of public review. And another thing you should know about ex parte. So generally, you will make an oral decision, and then you'll have another meeting where it gets, the findings are reduced to writing, and then you approve of an order. Ex parte can happen after the record is closed and before you sign off on the order. So you don't talk to the applicant, because you could change your mind until you have it reduced to writing and signed off by the Planning Commission. You haven't made a final decision. So you need to avoid ex parte contacts after you've made a decision and before you sign off on the thing, okay? There's some case law I pulled. What's neat is you can do this. You can Google LUBA, and they have a section called Head Notes. And they're all in different categories, and it's all very well organized. And so this section has to do with impartial tribunal, and these are all the cases on that. But one of the cases I saw actually said what I just said, so we need to be careful about that. So here's the deal. If you have an ex parte contact, it does not invalidate the decision. Ex parte contacts can be announced, and that's what you're supposed to do. So if someone came to you and started talking to you about a case, the way to handle it would be is Yeah, I got something to put on the record here when the chair starts this out and asks for ex parte contact. He said, on such and such a date, Joe Blow contacted me regarding this case. He started talking about it. I told him, no, I can't listen. I can't hear you out. I'm a decision maker. So you put it on the record. And then if anybody in the audience has questions about you, about your contact, they can ask those questions. That's how you cure an ex parte contact. An ex parte contact does not mean that the decision is tainted or invalid.
Or that
if it's announced. If it's not announced, then that's a basis for setting aside the decision.
Okay. So you got to disclose. Just disclose.
Yes, it's a disclosure thing.
Disclose the contact, and then it's fine.
Then it's fine. It's no big deal, but we need to do that. If we've had a contact, you know, we need to be careful about
it. And they haven't. Right? You know what it's like. In fact, all the details, even after Brian Booth, we had an individual from Seal Rock approached one of our planning commissioners about talking to all, wanted the contact information for all the planning commissioners. It's like, no.
Okay, so...
The record is closed, right? Record is closed. That would not be appropriate.
Okay, next concept. Okay, what's wrong with this?
I was going to say, but if it was a higher tribunal, then the rules for ex parte contact change, right? So if it was like a LUPA decision or something, not at the planning commission level.
Well, I think it was even if it was appealed to our board of commissioners, because typically their appeals could also some matters
go to the commissioners.
Board of commissioners.
Right.
I think they've got to go through the same exercise.
Any local government or planning commission. These are the rules.
Yes, that's right. Yeah. So it's local government, planning commission, and commissioners.
Yeah, we're not warranting that this is also stands throughout the legal system.
Right, exactly. Yeah.
So I told you that these are related but not the same concept. So this is how it's related. May introduce bias or unfairness. And the concept is evidence with no opportunity for rebuttal. So if you don't tell somebody about that person who tried to influence you or gave you some information, then that's not really fair. Remember, Fasano and quasi-judicial means we're going to have a fair proceeding. That's the whole concept, fairness. And so it's not going to happen if you don't announce your ex-party contacts. Generally, the rule is avoid the contacts, but if it happens, then you disclose. That's what Ano said. Disclose it. Describe the circumstances and any new facts or evidence introduced. So that's, I think we can get better on these things. And we just need to remember this. So if it introduces new evidence...
Next part A is confused with bias here in a second, that you're going to get into bias.
Yes, I'm going to get into bias in a minute. And this is what we said before. It doesn't forbid ex parte contacts. If you've had such a contact, you still may participate in the decision if it's disclosed. And another very important concept, which I think you know, is there's a separate law, 15422 and Beaverton versus City, Dickus versus City of Beaverton, and a few other cases. But you can contact staff as much as you want about a decision, and that's not ex parte. But staff's obligation is to talk to you solely about the law and procedure and that sort of thing. The staff cannot do an indirect saying, oh, it's not in the record, but so-and-so let us know. No, you can't do that. In other words, staff isn't to give you any evidence, I would say, that's not in the record. But the idea of contacting staff is asking questions about procedure and the law and that sort of a thing. And that's not an ex parte contact.
And I think that also goes to... We can have conversations, right? Because you just said that, right? We can have conversations with them.
That's okay.
Right?
And that's encouraged because that's why staff is here, is to help. Let's get that concept. I think it's so important that Planning Commission members retain their decision-making power. Staff can help guide you, but we do not step in your shoes. It is important that those functions of advising you about the law and procedure are separate from your decision making. And so, you know, it's not meant, you are not to be a rubber stamp for whatever staff might recommend or not, you know, in that way. You're to have your independent judgment, understand that it's good to understand the law, follow the law as best you can, but we don't make the decision, you do, and we respect that, right? I mean, yeah.
Amen.
Yeah. Okay.
Those lines of authority are very clear, right?
Yeah.
They get paid, we don't.
Yeah.
Well, we're glad to give you some of these decisions. Trust.
Site visits.
Ever be ex parte contact?
Yes. Site visit is a form of ex parte contact. So I always get nervous when we're a good part of the way through the thing and someone from the commission might say, oh, I was there a week ago and I saw, ooh, and I start getting nervous. The only good thing about that is it's sort of like it's getting announced. Remember, all these things are supposed to be announced at the beginning, but it's getting announced, and in theory, if someone didn't like it, they should raise it.
So if it gets announced later on, then that's still disclosing it, and that counts as kind of...
I would argue that that's okay, but let's talk about site visits.
Jerry, I've always been confused about this because when you live in a community and you know these places, you've been to them before. I mean, it's not like, you know, right? So if you have some existing knowledge about, all of a sudden that was a land use case about a particular spot, but you've been there before and you have knowledge of it.
Yeah, I mean, you can announce that and you probably, maybe you don't need to do that, but I think frequently what will happen is, you'll have an application, it'll be for an area that you're not that familiar with. It's not in your backyard, and you went out of your way to check it out. And that is in the nature of an ex parte contact. And the argument is that you're gaining knowledge, that's why you went there. You're gaining knowledge not in the record. And so there are different ways of handling that. Now there's at least one case that I've seen recently that seems to say, well, hell, you can probably get away with it if you haven't talked to the parties and stuff like that and all that. But it is not a good practice because you're gaining knowledge not in the record. And one way to handle it is if you did a site visit, announce it like it was an ex parte contact. And if anybody has any questions about what you learned, they can ask it. It's cured. It's not going to be a defect.
Because at that point, you're making it part of the record.
Yes, that's right. That's a good point. And so remember that the way these work is that if there's a first of all, the way to lose a LUBA, the way to lose a decision, so to speak, is procedural. And that's what you want to avoid, right? So what I'm trying to say is these things are correctable. We want to do them right. And as best we can. And in land use, you have extreme discretion as planning commission members, not complete. You have to have substantial evidence, but that gives you a lot of latitude. But there isn't always a lot of latitude when it comes to procedural matters. And the way LUBA will look at it is, did it prejudice the substantial rights of interested people? And so not every screw up is going to get remand, but it could. And so we want to kind of stay out of, you know, there's always something to argue, well, you know, it wouldn't have made a difference anyway for this reason, whatever.
So Jerry, one last point about that site visit thing, because I was going to ask that question, I'm glad you didn't want. Here's what's counterintuitive about that, you all know this. Actually visiting the property, even briefly, is so informative.
It can be,
and we were just saying this with our students this summer. It's like, go visit the place. You gotta go look at it because you're gonna. We experience that all the time, right? When at a staff level, is that I've always made the comment. I don't think I've ever done a site visit where I didn't come away with a much better understanding of what's really going on. And
that's right.
Corrected a lot of misses. I was wrong. We're supposed to guard against that. That's just counterintuitive.
I think site visits are fine. I think the argument would be just do them right. So, for instance, if you were going to have the Planning Commission meet at least twice, at the first meeting, they could say, okay, we'll do a site visit The time will be, the date will be the 9th of this month. We're going to do it at 6 o'clock.
It's noticed.
It's, and everybody, and you don't have to publish notice, but you tell everybody who's here. And the theory is, if you're interested party, then you're here. You're welcome to come, but don't talk to the Planning Commission members and, or whatever the rules are. And actually, if you announce it, you could talk to the parties there, I think.
If it was a duly noticed.
If it was duly noticed, and then, actually, a site visit is not a meeting in Chapter 192 Public Meetings Law, but to get to the point. No, even a quorum. But people would have the right then, on the following meeting, to ask questions of what you learned at the site visit. And so that is probably the best way to handle a site visit. If you don't handle that way, and you do it yourself, and you just go out there and take a look at the thing, then put it on the record and let people ask you questions.
Are you aware of other jurisdictions actually having formal?
Yes, in Curry County we did.
Right. I can imagine it'd be very effective at times.
We did that in Curry County many times. That was the county I was from. I was council there for nearly 30 years.
And you noticed them, right?
We noticed it. And, you know, it can be important, especially on the big controversial ones. And where, I think there are cases where a site visit can be particularly helpful, and maybe some where less so. But if it's particularly helpful, maybe it's not a bad idea to have a site visit, you know? So I'm not saying don't do a site visit. I'm just saying it's really in the nature of an ex parte, and so handle it that way.
Through disclosure.
Through disclosure.
Well, what about, I'm very familiar with a lot of that land around where the state park is beside. I knew Ken Zeke when he had his mules on the property. We knew the Katie's, where the center is now. I used to ride my horse back there down to Beaver Creek. And,
so, I you know.
What do you do with that?
I think that.
You just disclose it.
You could disclose it. You could disclose it.
And that's not the other thing.
Whether it's an old experience or just a week before the Planning Commission, you can just disclose it.
I don't think it hurts any to disclose it. And if someone has a question, they can. You're certainly protected that way.
On the Snaggy Point?
Yeah, I'm hiking it all the time. And I drive, that's my neighborhood, and I'm driving by it. So.
That'd be the conservative approach, which certainly wouldn't hurt. Okay, let's move on. Okay, we talked about the groupings of three things. Bias is the second. Bias is the concept that you really can't make a decision based on the evidence and applicable criteria. And you know, this talks about strongly held personal beliefs that, you know, somebody's really at a disadvantage when the thing starts. And so if that's the case, generally you should excuse yourself. Now, you know, so in criminal law, this could come up. Let's suppose you had a death penalty case. And so the judge will be asking, and voir dire ask questions of the potential jurors. And they would say, one of them might say, never, you know, it's against my religion. I would never vote for capital punishment or something like that. Well, that's a bias that, you know, never, that means that you're not going to listen to the evidence and all that. So the never thing is important. And so the idea in Fasano is all applicants and everybody involved in a case gets a fair shake. They can't get a fair shake because you are really biased, then declare that and do not make the decision. If you step down and you're not going to make the decision, come off the front. Don't pretend like you're one of the Planning Commission members acting on the thing. So you can go in the audience or leave the room. Either is fine. And don't sort of interject like, oh, I don't agree with that. So, you know, you're out of the decision if you disqualify yourself, right? If you disqualify yourself, don't pretend like you're still.
Jerry, is it rare that happens?
Yes, and I'll tell you why. In Oregon, LUBA recognizes that everybody has some preconceived ideas. We're not perfect. We're all influenced by different things, right? So this doesn't mean that you don't have, you know, some preconceived ideas or this or that, but this really has to do with giving somebody a fair shake. And if you're really biased, it doesn't happen very often. There's a high standard. So let me play the other side of the coin. If I'm a land use attorney and I want to get something set aside for bias, that's a hard burden. That's a really hard burden. It could happen. Let me give you an example. I pulled some of the head notes. This one's funny. County commissioner wrote a newspaper editorial criticizing petitioner as a terrorist. Yeah, that probably, you know, showed a little bias and it probably wouldn't fly. But that probably wasn't the world's best idea. And, and that was just because they were using the land use system. So that showed a strong emotional bias. And if you had some language like that, well, I think they can show bias. But just usually you don't get there. Usually bias is hard to show and requires some, quite a bit. But when somebody does something really stupid like that, well, that's...
If that's all you got, you're in trouble for your client.
Yeah. Okay, so
Sean's got a question back
here. We got a question. Sean?
So you can have like a political disposition and have a stance, but as long as you're willing to hear both sides and make an adjudication based on the evidence, then that's fine.
That's right. So let me give you an example. It might be that someone might feel that you're affected because you live immediately adjacent to where the application is, okay? The application for this parcel, you're right next to it. And so I think the way to handle that is you put on the record at the beginning when the chair says, do you have any bias, ex parte contact, conflict of interest? You say, well, I live immediately adjacent to the area of the application, but you know what? I feel that I can be fair and impartial, and that works. That generally is fine. Now, someone could challenge and say, well, I don't think you are. Then that planning commission member could make a judgment call about where to go with that. And so usually they don't, but this is raise it or waive it kind of stuff, and then this is the chance to respond, you know.
I was accused of bias once in a hearing. I forget which attorney it was, because I used to be on the Oregon Shores. Do you remember that, Judy? Were you here?
Oh, you just triggered a memory.
Okay, but that kind of thing will almost never fly.
Yeah, well, I was just like, are you kidding? Totally going to listen to the evidence. Yeah. But I don't even remember what case it was. I just remember being shocked that this attorney
accused me. That was a long time ago. You just triggered a memory. I remember that night.
Yeah.
Well, you know what's happening in D.C. right now, the same dynamic, and I'm not trying to inject politics, so this is just the most public of all of these bias claims are right now, whether that FBI agent, because he had some personal emails, somehow couldn't put those feelings aside and carry out his job as an investigator independent of that. And I think what happens is, as a practical matter, if you're persuaded someone, even their personal opinions can color how they arrive at a professional opinion. I mean, we can see obviously that FBI agent is saying this over and over again, but there are a host of people that do not believe him, that he somehow could separate those roles. But our framework is basically saying absolutely it's possible to separate those roles.
Yeah. Question.
So if there's a person with the submitted testimony or something like that, and they are accusing a planning commissioner of being biased on something.
Yes.
And say they're aggressive and saying, I want this addressed now.
Yeah.
What would be the recourse of the planning commission in that situation? They would just say, we're not putting up to vote, that person has disclosed this and doesn't feel it's a conflict of interest. Bias, I guess.
So you always rely on your local procedures. There are some local procedures that would say, for instance, a whole group votes on the thing and stuff. We don't have anything like that. I think that the way I look at it is that ultimately I think that the person who's accused of bias or whatever should hear what the person has to say and take any comments from the Planning Commission as a whole. The other members may have some feeling. And if there is still, let's go over these concepts. We've gone over some really good concepts that are helpful. But if there are enough Planning Commission members to carry a decision, then, and there's really a possible issue about bias, and it's not just a harassing thing, it may be best that that Planning Commission member step down, okay? So the concepts, let's go over
even
now.
Even if they really think they have the ability to separate their personal views from the facts of it.
Yeah, I mean, if it's something silly like you belong to an organization some time ago or something, you know. But, you know, that I wouldn't go that far. But if they feel, well, you know, God, you live right next to the development, I could see how you could be affected. Well, maybe you step down, you know. Or, you know, you're right on the property of the development. Maybe that's not a bad thing. Because remember what I told you is a lot of times land use matters decide on procedure. Land use is largely procedure. You can do a hell of a lot. You have great discretion as long as you don't, you know, commit procedural error. So there's a lot there. So the concept I was going to talk about is quorum. A number of people to keep to carry a vote, and remember those are two separate concepts. So quorum is the number of people that must convene to do business. So you have a 9-member planning commission, I think, basically here. So the answer would be 5. Generally,
let's vote for 5.
5 is a quorum, but it becomes an interesting thing. Let's say that we do have a quorum. And what happens is, well, hell, one of the Planning Commission members is a conflict, and so they can't decide, and then another one has got bias, and so now you've got 3 members, and there's another one, and that one has another problem, and actually just wants to step down, and so you have 2 left. Well, 2 people cannot carry a decision. If you go on your local rules, we don't have anything different. But so, in the absence of local rules, the AG manual says that, you know, I think it takes 5 to carry a vote. So you get these people, I've seen where maybe minutes got approved where, you know, 3 or 4 people voted. We don't want to do that. It takes 5 to carry a vote.
So if
okay.
You have 5 in a quorum, those 5 have to.
That's why we need to have 9 members here, if at all possible.
An abstention is still a vote, because that's typically if you have people here and they don't want to vote in affirmative on the minutes.
An abstention is not a vote. It's the opposite. So you should generally have as close to 9 people here as possible, because if indeed you have problems of people not being able to vote, you may have a quorum, but then not enough to carry the vote, and that's a concern. Okay, so that
happens a lot.
Yeah.
Because
under five,
when we're a lot of times, like a phone meeting or something, when we're just approving something
minutes.
That we made a decision, but then we have to.
We need the five. Have a meeting, so we're up and running, right? So I'm just trying
right.
to understand what you're thinking.
But she's saying sometimes there could be less than 5 that vote.
I think generally most people approve. That's what.
Even if they weren't at the meeting, like the minutes or the finding, the final.
And of course people abstain because they weren't there the previous week.
Right.
Well, there's another problem. Let's say that you have 5 here, and this wouldn't be uncommon. Well, I don't know if it's uncommon or not, but you could have 3 voting in favor and 2 against. That's a problem.
Well, wait a minute. Generally speaking, the chair doesn't vote unless there's a. Would be 2 and 2.
But we don't have that.
Not for us.
No, the chairman.
We don't have that in the deal.
We don't have a chairman step down.
We don't have that.
We have that they vote.
So I'm saying this for maximum flexibility.
I paid attention to.
Yeah, for maximum flexibility, we want as many Planning Commission members here as possible. Okay, here we go. conflicts of interest. This is the third leg of this area here. Now, conflicts of interest, I think you may know this, are they're in the statute, chapter 244. And chapter 244 governs all kinds of things relating to public officials, like receiving gifts and all kinds of stuff. But for our purposes, what we're talking about here is having an actual conflict of interest or a potential conflict of interest, okay? Now, conflict of interest is a pecuniary concept. So if you're making a decision that could put money effectively in your pocket, or money in your family's pocket, or money in your own business in your pocket, that's a conflict. And if it could do the opposite, so it's to your benefit or detriment, if it could cost you money, that's a conflict as well. So two kinds of conflicts, and the words that are critical are in green, would or could. So on the would, we'll get to it, but if there is an actual, that's a would, then you disclose and depart. You cannot make a decision. That's the general rule. If you have, so if there's a business that's the applicant and you have shares in the business or some business interest in it, that's a problem. And
that's a direct.
That's a direct or actual conflict of interest. And you would step down from up here and you would put it on the record that you have that conflict, why you have the conflict, and then not make the decision, okay? And not participate in the decision. Not just making the decision. You step down.
Right, because you don't. We, in that kind of situation, we don't even want people being there for deliberation. Because you know what it's like. I mean, for us, that's 99% of what's important is when you guys deliberate. Because we just don't have close votes very often. There's you develop a consensus among yourselves. So
yeah. So and then the potential is could. So you disclose it. It's like the ex parte contact. The concept is disclose. You disclose it, and you can participate in the decision, meaning you sit up there, listen to the evidence, make a decision. Now, there's an exception to the actual, but if that ever comes up, we'll talk about it, but I don't want to get into it now. But that's the main thing there. Okay, now, what do you think about this? Yeah, forget about that.
So you're free to move on to that point.
This one?
The previous point. From a staff perspective, that potential conflict, because we have to be careful about gifts, right? I mean, that's our thing, is that there's a $50, as you know. Right?
Wait a second.
Well, you don't. It doesn't matter that if it's a couple.
The actual, right? There's a couple. If a person mm-hmm. that wants to do something nice for us has a potential. And then there's always the appearance thing, which is, you know, probably even the actual is a no-brainer. Potential is a sort of a real liberalization of this concept, like, whoa, you better be careful to potentially stand out, or at least disclose it.
Yeah.
And so, but I know we're very careful of that, but even we, you know, if someone wants to buy us lunch or something like that.
Yeah, don't. Just.
Am I overthinking that?
No, I think that if there's an application pending or some such thing, you don't receive anything of value from the person. I'd be careful. You're not the decision maker.
We are.
But just avoid appearance of impropriety. Okay, here we go.
We are very careful about that, aren't we?
Yes.
So Fasano and quasi-judicial is all about fairness. Everybody gets their chance. And this explains all that. Okay, I think we know those. Okay, so there is important relevance to closing the hearing. When is it closed? And this concept of before it's closed, A person withstanding can request to continue the hearing or leave the record open. And this choice is actually with the Planning Commission. It's almost always better, well, it just depends. But generally, I like the concept of leaving the record open, because if you continue the hearing, and you know we have the 120 and 150 day thing, this thing can go on and on and on. And with the close the hearing but leave the record open for at least 7 days, you can see the end at the light at the end of the tunnel and manage the time much better.
But we're obligated to get...
Opponents can't ask for that, can they? But that was only the applicant that could ask.
A participant is any
outstanding for a week.
Okay, but they can't.
And then if they do, if that happens, uh-huh, then the applicant still gets another week after that, though, right, to provide rebuttal testimony for anything submitted.
Okay, so let's go over this, and we did this. So first of all, the concept of standing is very important. Standing means that you either appeared personally and gave testimony, or you submitted something to the record. Then you have standing with it when the record was still open. So then you have standing, and standing means many things. It means that you have the right to appeal. It means that you have the right to ask for a continuance or leave the record open, and that's what we're talking about here. And so it's not just the applicant, it could be anybody who testified here. Then, under the statute, you have to allow 7 days, or at least 7 days. The middle concept is, here's the problem. And so you leave the record open for 7 days. New evidence, something that nobody has even heard of before, might come in during that 7 days. And a principle of Fasano, the case we talked about, is you have the right to rebut. So how in the hell can you rebut if we just have the 7 day open and then it's argument? Really, the better way to handle this is to do a 7-7-7, but there are other ways of handling this, and we handle it differently in the Salishan case. But 7 days, leave the record open, and then you can say 7 days for rebuttal, and that is if new stuff comes in, and then 7 days is the final argument, which only the applicant has, because they have the burden of proof. Okay, that's why this rule exists. Only the applicant has the right to submit written argument. So that's the better way to do it. In the one recent case we did, we just did 7-7 with the idea that if new evidence came in and the applicant or somebody asked for additional time because new evidence came in, we would have had to restructure that and give them another 7 days. We were, Huey and I were discussing that strategy. And that works too, but probably the better way to do it is 7-7-7. The other way could be more economical if you're under a time constraint. So we talked about that. Let's move on. Here, this talks about the 7-7-7. And these materials generally come from DLCD. I had to modify them a lot because it was done for a city and there were other things that were outdated and repealed and so on. But that's where a lot of this journey came from. And this explains what we just talked about. Okay. Making the decision, you have four choices, although I would like to talk about the last one in particular. But you can approve the application, but as I said, all the criteria have to be met. That's fine. Or you could approve subject to conditions. We talked about conditions a little bit before. They have to be designed to achieve compliance. You can't just make them up, you know, the purple fence or whatever. It's got to tie in, as Anna was talking about. Or you could deny the application, and that could be just even if they failed to meet one of the criteria. Or, and then it says continue the review. That means, well, I mean, you could leave the record open or continue the hearing or close the record and just give yourself more time to deliberate. You know, those are all choices. But eventually, you need to make a decision. It isn't allowed that you would just indefinitely continue. We're all on the shot clock.
The shot clock. Okay. Kicking the can down the road.
So you're going to make a decision based on evidence in the record and on the approval criteria. You're not going to do it on your personal values, opinions. Oh, I've seen where people have come to me or someone else and said, well, hell, you know, did you see the petition? I said, we had 40 people sign the petition, you know? And so you should grant the application or something. Well, petitions are, in my opinion, meaningless generally. It doesn't matter how many people are for or against something. The issue is, what evidence is there to support the decision? What evidence is there that satisfies the decision criteria? But I do see, and I don't know if it's come up here, but in Curry County it came up on a number of occasions where people signed a petition or something. And
people ask us all the time, would it help if we, I mean, there's, you know, and one of my standard refrains to people when they ask about that is the land use program is not a popularity contest.
It is not. That's a good point.
We don't sort of say, all right, we've got more people than not. Now, we saw that with Shavis Alishan, right, that people were on both sides were coming and the applicants were making sure they had a certain number of people in the audience. I don't know if that was for atmospherics or not, but...
Well, they were trying to explain their way out.
Yeah, but the larger case of it really is, and we make sure we tell people all the time, right, guys? It's like, it's not about an angry neighbor that doesn't like you. It's about addressing the criteria. But we can't sort of prohibit people from...
Another way people get noticed, that they're expanding the notice area sometimes. When the people start a petition, it's more... I think they're trying to get more people aware and maybe come to a hearing.
Yeah, and
you know, but then they have to be here. The petition itself is nothing to us, but they're here and then address the criteria.
If people on their own want to give us a petition, Jerry, I would think that we just got to make sure when you're deliberating and you give us instructions on findings that it isn't, you don't anchor a finding to a petition.
Right.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Well, yeah. It's based solely on
as interesting and as a gauge of how the you can't deny it. It could be a gauge of how whether there's compatibility. I mean, it would be, we can't unlock that obvious connection in our minds, but our findings better not show that.
Yeah. You bring up a good point. Is in my experience in land use, and I learned the hard way a couple times. With LUBA, if someone wants to introduce evidence. And there's an issue about how relevant it is, and so it could be a petition or something, you know, really doesn't need, just accept it, because there's really almost no penalty for accepting things into the record, but there is if you exclude it and someone says, well,
you want to err on the side of taking it in, but just make sure your findings
just give it what weight it give it what weight it deserves, which might be nothing, but generally, it's the safest to take most everything in, you know. I mean, someone wants to introduce something, generally take it, you know. There could be reason not to, but that's the general.
Well, for all of this talk, we know what it's like if all of a sudden there are 80 really angry people in the room, right? It just changes the dynamic. You can't help but ignore it when you're up there, you know, how many nights that...
Okay, here we go. And we're going to wrap up in a couple minutes because that meant to be done in about 5. So frequently evidence will conflict, and this is the job of the Planning Commission, you know, decide what evidence you're going to rely on. Remember that substantial evidence concept we went over. And the criteria is going to be in the staff report, but there's not going to be a moving goalpost. This could come up when... let's say that the application is filed on April 1st and the legislature just had a session and they changed the law Well, you're going to go on the law that existed when the application was deemed complete, not something that happened 2 months in or something. That's not fair. That's what we call changing the goalposts, using a sports metaphor. And so we don't do that. We go on the criteria applied at the time of the application. And then it's all, one of the hardest things that staff has to do is help you come up with findings of fact. Findings of fact and conclusions of law, you know, what is it that supports the decision? And one of the incredibly interesting things is, like it came up in this Fasano case, you can't have findings that will fly that are just conclusory. Like an example might be, we denied the application because it would adversely affect the neighborhood. Okay, that looks like a, what are your, why? What does it do to the neighborhood?
Too much noise, too many people, something more.
That's where you develop the findings of fact. You can't just make a general statement and say that's going to fly. It will never fly. Luba hates just general conclusions that are not supported by evidence. That's why the evidence is important. Okay, so findings of fact, incredibly important concept. Uh-oh. Kind of feel sorry for the guy. I mean for the lobster. Or the shrimp. Okay. So findings of fact. We talked about it quite a bit. If there's any questions, let me know. But that explains that. So identify the approval standard, set out the facts relied upon, explain how they lead to the conclusion. Satisfy the approval standards. I'm giving you a citation there. Okay.
Which is, again, that facts and then anchoring it to a code.
Yes, anchoring it to a code. Decision without a hearing is possible, and I think we have that process, don't we? For some things, staff could issue a decision, and then notice is sent out. And so, as long as you have the right to appeal and de novo hearing will be held, that's all legal. It's allowed. Uh-oh. That didn't work out real well. Okay. So appeals, basically, LUBA was formed in 1979. And land use matters generally go before LUBA. There are some exceptions, but generally they go before the Land Use Board of Appeals, which is a panel of three. It's kind of like going to the appeals court, but it's an administrative agency. An incredibly important thing is that a final decision is issued, then parties adversely affected have 21 days to file, it's called a NIDA, or Notice of Intent to Appeal to LUBA. This is jurisdictional. If a party does not file within the 21 days, they lose all ability to carry that to the next level, and the local decision becomes final. Okay.
And that's why it's so important for us, looking over at Josh here, right, that we, once we have our, you know, findings, and once you've looked at them, and either on a conference call or in person, and then the chair signs that finding,
yeah,
because that's the moment, right, then it's actionable.
Yeah. There are always some exceptions if we didn't get the notice out and somebody didn't know, and there's all kinds of case law on that. But basically, it's from the date of the decision, 21 days.
The signed order.
We talked about
the night of the planning.
We talked about standing and that important concept, how it applies to so many different things. So we won't go there anymore. LUBA really has three choices: to affirm a decision, reverse, or remand. And let me tell you that, in my experience, LUBA sometimes affirms. almost never reverses and very frequently remands. Remands means the decision comes back to the local body
with
instructions on how to make a better decision and correct a mistake. Okay? So remand is very common. It's hard to, with so many decision criteria, if you're going to approve something, frequently it's hard for that to be sustained. Pretty easy to have enough findings to support a denial. But frequently, a remand is very common. And frequently the problem is that findings are inadequate. That's frequently what the problem is. Sometimes it's a procedural matter, but more often than not, findings are inadequate. And generally, LUBA will defer to local government's interpretation of its own plan and land use regulations, but that deference does not go to the Planning Commission, only goes to the Board of Commissioners. And I could explain that, but maybe we're running out of time.
So ultimately, the remedy for a remand is staff goes back and does a better job of connecting the dots on establishing findings, or does it sort of start over again? Or?
Generally, it does not start over again. Generally, what happens is that you have a LUBA decision, and the local governing body will make a decision as to the scope of a hearing, if a hearing. So, actually, there's an opportunity to frequently it's inadequate finding, so you can open the record, have better findings, more evidence put in. Or not. So a question on remand is, do we leave the record open again, or is it closed and we're just going to make better findings and that kind of a thing? So there's in the absence of a local procedure, some jurisdictions have a local procedure, we do not, you have great flexibility in how you handle a remand. And if you are going to have a hearing, give the full notice. Yeah.
We haven't had any, have we?
Wayne is really good. When we've been taking LUBA, we've got Wayne is like a LUBA ninja. So he does a hell of a job. When he does his deal with LUBA,
he will present it.
Yeah, he writes it up. Well, I know, and there is a oral argument, right? I've been to LUBA once, just to watch it once at one time. That's really, if something's going to LUBA, it's over with you guys here at County Council.
Yes, only attorneys for a municipality can represent the jurisdiction, and I've done that sometimes. LUBA doesn't come up that often, but sometimes I've had one matter before the Court of Appeals. I've been before the Supreme Court.
Well, Wayne's got quite a reputation out there in the land use field. So, for instance, on goal 18 with riprap, his opinion on fishing rock is still seen as like the ultimate statement of if you bring up in certain circles, you can be says, "Oh yeah, that LUBA opinion out of Lincoln County on fishing rock is the definitive statement on goal 18." So we're lucky to have someone with this caliber, Jerry's caliber.
So
we're very happy to send it over there. That's beautiful.
I'm curious, I have a question about 21 day appeal to LUBA.
Okay.
Is that when everything is done at local level, once it's all passed through the DOC and all that, then they have 21 days to appeal to LUBA?
21 days from the date of the decision. That's what the cases would say.
So if the decision is a conditional use, which doesn't go to the PLC, is it still 21 days?
Yes. Time out. If most, I'm not completely familiar with our procedure here, but most areas, the Planning Commission makes a decision, the next level appeals the Board of Commissioners. Is that?
For many issues, I believe that, yeah.
Yes. So generally, it would go to the Board of Commissioners.
You're talking about administrative conditional use situation?
Well, I'm talking about, for example, for a zone change, you know, once the Planning Commission approves it, it goes to the PLC to be adopted as an ordinance.
Yeah.
But as for conditional use, the decision is at the Planning Commission level, and it doesn't go to the PLC unless the appeals. And our code says they have 15 days to appeal to the POC.
Yeah.
So is it 15 or is it 21?
So I think it has to go to the, if I understood your question right, it has to go to the Board of Commissioners first. You have to exhaust your local remedies first.
There's a discrepancy between what Jerry just said on appeal time and whatever.
Well, I just don't understand exactly which one is 15, which one is 21.
21 days is when it's ready to go to LUBA. 15 is when it goes to the next level here, right?
Okay.
Okay.
Good question.
I don't want to keep anybody any longer because we went a little bit longer than I wanted. Do you have anything? Huh?
Your slideshow up on that?
We can make that available.
You don't have to put the comics in with it.
Oh, but the comic. I think they're.
Can I email to you guys?
Yeah, sure.
Yeah, let's, since we've had a few absent planning commissions. I've got a lot out of this, Jerry. I really thought that was excellent. Thank you.
Thank you. Yeah, so I think what we'll do is I'll talk to Anno, but we will send it out to all the Planning Commission members. So you have a copy of it, and those who didn't attend have a copy of it. It's too bad that more people didn't show up, but the way I look at it is for those of you who did, I hope, you know, that you learned and that we learned together, because that's the way it is.
This stuff needs to be refreshed, because you can have a training a long time ago and...
I only had one when I first started. There was a few years ago. There was something got sent. I think I went to Salem to the DLCD or something, and they had a training.
Oh, really?
Yeah. When I first got a
training. When I first went on the Planning Commission a bazillion years ago, I think I went to one.
It was about the same time, you and I.
Yeah, I think I remember one. Maybe at the town hall. When the town hall was still over where the Big and Pancake is, there was some kind of sort of workshop.
Maybe it was there, but there was something for newly.
Yeah.
And I think that was really useful for.
For beginners.
Yeah, just the procedure and how the hearings roll out.
Right, and you know what we want to have, and because I know we're at the end here, but I think when we get together with all, and some of you have expressed some concerns to me that we've had a very loose arrangement about, you know, we got to, and I've been trying to, and we'll get there, where people, you know, let the chair sort of service, you know, get acknowledged by the chair before speaking. And certainly this unfortunate, but it's we're all humans. So someone asks a question from the audience, we've done an awful lot of just sort of turning around ad hoc up here, engaging people in the audience. And that, you know, that just gets out of control really quickly, and the expectations are that, you know, and I love conversation. In fact, I used to probably be the worst one when I was in the Planning Commission. I probably jumped down the line more often than most people and asked, sorry, not to put to the audience as much as just ask the applicant something. But we just got to, in addition to everything we've talked about today, that kind of little more, you know, rigidity, but it just allows for a much more orderly meeting. So we'll take that matter up. But again, thank you, Jerry, and thank you guys for being here.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Do we have an idea of what's coming up?
What's next?
Next on the agendas?
We've got some code amendment things. It'll be two different nights where we have a few relatively minor code amendments. We're expecting any day a redo on Salishan PD.
They haven't submitted yet.
Haven't heard that they actually submitted, but it's coming. And I think Salishan may be having, the Alpha Wave, I should say, should be having a conditional use. We're hearing they want to provide a satellite camping operation up on the Alsea River. And so that, we're going to have to take that on in terms of what they're doing and more what else we got there on the upcoming Planning Commission.
Are we going to see the Brian Booth?
Yes, you're right. Oh, I'm sorry. Thank you. Absolutely. I have some draft recommendations done. I'll complete them and get them to you, and then we'll schedule a
you know, you could look at it and sort of tell us, do we need to meet in person, or should, or do you want to just give me some commentary and have a phone call to approve the file? So I really, after that meeting, I spent the first day or two getting a lot of progress on that, so that's coming okay.
Okay.
But you guys need to look at it and say, is, you know, this is all about me taking my first best shot, and you gotta be blunt with me and say, I think you got it or you didn't get it. So please don't be passive on it, if you think. And there were times.
You're gonna send us some preliminary.
I will send you a draft set of recommendations, right? Yes, and then you'll act on that. But I encourage you to be clear of this, so wait a minute, I don't, because you know, there were times where a number of you felt differently that night, and it sort of wobbled a little bit, so.
Yeah.
We've got the recording, and, but I'm trying not to overthink this, and Jerry counseled me too, that there's a sort of a certain key set of points that we've made. So I hope to have that to you soon.
Just, what is, in the bigger picture, since we've never done anything like this, and you know, this goes to the board and to the state park, the recommendations. I mean, can the state parks commission just say, oh, that's all fine and dandy, and you, when you guys come together and try to, you know, come to some agreement, and they say, no, the county won't agree with us on this, what happens then?
I don't know. It's the first time we've done this. There are very powerful, influential, political undertones and overtones to all of this.
Right.
If they act really high-handed, I'm not sure that's going to go over well. Let's remember, they need at the end of the day to come back to us for the rezone. And so that's an unusual circumstance as well. And so again, we marched through this ping pong game, but we issued a recommendation, they respond in writing, and then the county responds in writing. So we're gonna, I've been counseling people all along, at each one of these critical points, we're gonna have a lot more information to sort of see where we're at. I suspect some of the stuff they're not gonna wanna do, and they'll provide us a statement. They're obligated to say why, not just we're not gonna do it. And then it's gonna be up to our commissioners to say, do we wanna invoke the dispute resolution process on one or any of these matters? And what that does is drag us all into a multi-month continued conversation about this. And I sense from reading the administrative rules, at the very end of the day, they could probably outlast us or something. I'm not really sure. This is, you know, what they've been telling me is that, gee, you guys give us an awful lot more feet. We're used to sort of, you know, having this be a perfunctory thing. And I'm like, well, too bad. This is a big deal for our community, whether you like it or not.
Well, it's one of the largest state parks that they've done.
Yeah.
And it's one they put a lot of money into, too, so far.
Yeah, well, I hope.
Just not done yet.
I hope the better ideas that you've come up with in the observations are acted upon. And at the end of the day, we're going to, you know, this is obvious. The parks could be a very great thing for our community. There's some real positive advantages. So people feel that this is one of these situations where people feel very differently about the park, you know, the love and hate it. So
yeah, well, let's not get into it.
Yeah, no, you're very. It's an interesting experience.
Yeah.
So thank you.
Yeah.
Thank you.
Yeah.